This is the Good Neighbor Podcast, the place where local businesses and neighbors come together. Here's your host, Mike Sedita.
Hello out there. Welcome to episode number 142 of the Good Neighbor Podcast here in Pasco County. My name is Mike Sedita. I'm your host. Today, I'm joined by Diane Stoddard. She is the owner of Preparing for Tomorrow. Diane, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Mike.
I am so glad to have you on. This is one of my favorite topics because I kind of lived in this world for a little bit of time. So I'm very familiar with some of the novice experiences I had. So I love hearing about some of the stuff you do. So in case you're not aware of what the Good Neighbor Podcast is, how we got started and what we have going on, back during 2020, which I'm sure was probably an interesting time for you, when everybody had to be socially distant, the Good Neighbor Podcast was born as a way for business owners and companies and philanthropic groups in the area to let the community know what they had going on. And in the last 4 years, we've evolved into a national podcast with podcasts now in Denver, Atlanta, Virginia, all over the U.S. I'm lucky enough, even though I'm based in Pasco County, to talk to business owners all over the Tampa market in Central Florida about what they do. And with that said, tell us a little bit about Preparing for Tomorrow.
Okay, well, we're a long-term care consulting firm. So what I do is I help people prepare for their tomorrow when life takes a curveball and everything goes awry. And so they have a plan in place that says, this is what I want and this is how I'm going to pay for it.
So let me ask you your background. I mean, that's kind of like, it's almost like a financial component to it, right? And there's a medical component to it. Tell us a little bit about your background. Were you always in this field? How did you get into starting Preparing for Tomorrow?
Well, when I was 28, I lived in the cornfields in Illinois. And my mom, as smart as she was, called me up one November and said, how do you feel about moving to Florida? Your grandpa needs help taking care of your grandma with Alzheimer's. And I'm thinking, I don't know what Alzheimer's is, but it's November in Illinois. So how do I get there?
Sign me up for Florida. Yeah. Didn't know what you were getting into for sure.
At 28, no idea. But I learned fast. And then they did not have insurance. They had no plan. It was grandpa spend all his money till it's gone. And then grandma goes on Medicaid.
Right.
And then later when I found out that you can actually plan ahead for this kind of stuff and buy money that pays for it, I said, people need to know about this because if my grandpa didn't know about it, he knew everything, right? Because that's what grandpas are for.
They do. Yeah.
He didn't know about this. So I spent the last 20 some years of my career helping people prepare today for that tomorrow.
So how big, where are you based out of? Where are you located?
I'm in Tampa. I live in Carrollwood.
Okay, so you're in Carrollwood. And then do you service the entire Tampa area? Do you go up as far as Spring Hill and Ocala? Like, do you have a, are you working with the actual care or are you working with the preparation for the financial preparing so people mm-hmm. can actually go out and get the, you know, the care through Health South or Encompass or Advent Health or one of these companies that provides the service. Mm-hmm.
So I sell the money. I sell the insurance that pays for this stuff. And I work nationwide. I'm licensed in 44 states, I think now. There's only a couple that I'm not licensed in. So I help people since COVID. It's easier to work all over the country than it's ever been.
Yeah. So just so you know, like my background, and I kind of alluded to it a little bit. So my folks, my mom was my dad's caregiver. My dad had dementia and then he had a fall in 2017 where he was wheelchair bound, you know, and at that age, he was in his mid 70s. He just didn't feel like doing physical therapy, which a lot of people don't do. But he'd had a fall. And the one brilliant thing my mom and dad had done, my dad had all the Medicare and all that stuff. They had for him, they had a supplemental insurance policy. So he was covered. Like when I started taking care of them, any bill that we got that Medicare didn't cover, the supplemental plan covered. So it was like there was never a bill. Like there was just never a bill, which was great. And then but he couldn't qualify because he had had health issues for long-term care. Like the number that you would have put together for him because of his previous ailments was so astronomical. It was like, it just never seemed like it would pay off to do it. My mom, however, who was pretty healthy, relatively healthy, other than being a smoker, did get a long-term care plan.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out to be, and it, you know, this is an endorsement for this across the board. If they held me in a firing line, I'll always say this. It's the best thing my mom ever did, because even though she was relatively healthy, while my dad was sick and she was taking care of him, she all of a sudden went to get a test and they found a spot on her lung, had stage 3 lung cancer. From the time they found it till the time she passed away was about 18 months. But when she came out of the hospital, she was like, I don't know if I want to enact this long-term care plan. And I'm like, Mom, I don't know how much worse you need it to get. You just had your lung. Like, she's old school. You know, like, I'm not going to use this. I want to save it. I'm like, if you don't use it, it just goes away. You lose it.
Right.
And sure enough, it helped us. So I moved to Florida in 2019. She was coming out of surgery. She moved in with my ex-wife and I and my dad. And it was like a madhouse. The long-term care saved us. We had someone come in for, it was like 5 hours a day was her coverage. She had her limit that she got every week. We paid it. We submitted it. And it got it reimbursed. It was such a smooth transaction for us. And the nice thing about it was, even though my dad didn't have the long-term care, not that the caregiver was there to take care of him, but they're having lunch together. The caregiver isn't going to make my mom lunch and not mine, be like, hey, you don't eat today. But it helped with both of them. It got them interacting. So I 100% endorse your forward thinking for your clients and what you do. So anybody listening to this, I can tell you from me, getting long-term care was absolutely essential to my survival mentally as a caregiver and to my parents. I mean, that's the biggest thing. I made a joke about it being 28 and coming to Florida. I was in my late 40s and I'm like, yeah, sure. I'll take care of my parents. You know, they were always there for me, blah, blah, blah. The toll it takes on the caregiver, it's immeasurable. Like, I mean, there's really not a lot of places to turn. So having this service in place to just give me those 5 hours to work and to take a little mental break from the questions and the dementia and the Alzheimer's and all the stuff that was going on for my dad, crucially, I mean, amazing. So kudos. Right. I fully support it. So
right. So a lot of people think they're buying it for themselves, but really they're buying it for their family.
100%. It really was. And, you know, look, I know that all the plans vary depending on the amount of care that you want or need or think you're going to need. My mom kind of had a minimal plan. I think her premium was about, and again, this is not specific and I'm not going to give the name of the company or anything like that, but I think she paid about $1,500 a year for her plan. And it ultimately ended up covering for about $600 or $700 a week. Up until it would have lasted for like, I think it was like 7 or 9 years. Like the total benefit ended up being on the $1,500 a year, it was like $275,000 worth of benefits. Now, it's insurance, so she didn't use all of it, so they recouped some of that money. But the reality is $1,500 a year she paid into for 10 years. So she paid 15 grand into it, even though she only used it for about a year and a half. She still got more out of it than she put into it. So like, absolutely just amazing. And I know they do things on the back end, so they recoup their money. I get all that part of it, but well worth it. And you're absolutely right. It is for the caregiver. I mean, it saved me. And listen, my ex-wife, she's my ex-wife. We're not together anymore. My parents didn't have anything to do with the reason she's my ex-wife, because that happens to a lot of people.
It does.
They move in together, mom, in-laws move in, and, you know, it creates that. Definitely, I'm not saying it didn't create stress, but, you know, it really just, it helped us both be able to work. And then in the middle of all of it, COVID hits. So now you have two elderly adults, one with dementia, one who's hobbled by lung cancer, and two adults trying to work in the same house, in the same space. The caregiver was, our house was like Grand Central Station. We had in-home healthcare. We had all sorts of stuff coming in. We had OT, PT, you know, everything coming in. It was every day. It was like just somebody new coming in. The people in our community were like, what the heck's going on over there? So,
right.
So you deal with this day in and day out. What is one of the biggest misconceptions or myths? Like you just said, people think they're buying it for them. They're buying it for the caregiver. Mm-hmm. What's another thing that you kind of educate people on as to like, look, this is what this is really about?
Yeah. So a lot of people that I work with are younger. They're under 65 and they're thinking until they run into this problem with their parents, people think Medicare is going to pay for this because Medicare pays for old people, right?
Right. But
Medicare is health insurance. So it's going to pay for your doctors and your x-rays and your labs and your, you know, hospitals. It doesn't pay for custodial people to help you get around the house or get dressed or go to the bathroom. So Medicare doesn't do it. So the default plan is Medicaid. Spend all my money till it's gone and then rely on the state.
Right.
And having your own plan with insurance, just it's private pay. You're in control. You're making your own decisions. You're helping your family help you.
Yeah. I mean, I will tell you the one thing, I mean, I know you're in 44 states, but the one thing about Florida, and like, I didn't do this in other states. I did it here in Florida. At the time I was living in Hillsborough County, and I don't know like how, you know, if you're at how familiar you are with any of that stuff, but Hillsborough County really does have some amazing programs for elder care. Like the Department of Elder Services in Hillsborough County, the most amazing rep. I mean, I still remember her name, Julie, helped every step of the way. When my mom passed away and it was just my dad, he qualified because of his low income for certain services. And it was like undergarments and furniture drapes and medical, not equipment, but like Band-Aids and bandages and like mm-hmm. all this stuff he qualified for. A food service to help him supplement his food. Hillsborough County has great services, but again, that's all, like you said, relying on the state. So you're subjected to their stuff. Because he didn't make a certain amount, we were able to utilize some of those services. And it also included like a CNA to come in for a few hours. So we were lucky in that regard in Hillsborough County. And I think Pasco and Pinellas do similar stuff. Mm-hmm. But with my mom's stuff, the long-term care, the stuff that you work with, it was great because she got to pick, like we interviewed people for her services. We weren't tied by this is what they can provide. We were tied by these are the providers, pick the provider. So right. It really made a huge difference for us.
Right. And they'll stay longer because they're getting paid to stay longer. With Medicare and with county services, they're popping in and popping out.
Yeah. 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 It's punching a clock as opposed to creating the relationship is the only real way to describe it. I mean, from my perspective as watching it unfold in front of me.
Right.
So this is kind of heavy stuff that you're dealing with because the people you're talking to, you know, it's a gloomy thing to think about. Hey, what's going to be like at the end of my life? Like, how am I envisioning what I'm going to do towards the end of my life? So when you're not having these conversations, what do you do for fun? What do you do to let off steam?
Well, you heard my dog bark before we started this. He's my 7-year-old Australian Shepherd, Duck Choler Retriever, 50-pound lap dog. Okay. He has his own Facebook page with all his tricks on it. So we have fun as often as we can, doing a lot of really fun tricks.
Okay, so wait, we got to stop right there because you can see in the podcast, in the display, I mean, Norman is my brand. Norman is my 70-pound, big-boned, chubby-ish bulldog. He knows to sit, he knows to lay down, and he knows to give me a high five. What are some of the more elaborate tricks that your Australian Shepherd does?
Frank, well, some of the easy ones, he knows home run, so he can run the bases in a circle.
Wait, did you say his name is Frank?
Yeah, Frank Zappa.
Oh, very nice. Like it. Okay, so he runs the bases. Frank Zappa, he doesn't take acid or anything like that.
No,
he doesn't do anything
great.
Okay. Just making sure.
Yep. He knows touchdown. Right? Touchdown.
Okay.
He can walk with his front paws on my feet and we can walk around the house.
Okay.
He jumps over my back and he jumps through my arms.
So you have an athletic dog that does.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun.
So have you ever contemplated doing some like agility type stuff with him in a ring, or is he just, you know, like I like to do this for fun and treats?
Well, we were going to do agility, but he doesn't like other dogs.
Oh, okay. It happens. It happens. Norman has been bitten by 5 different dogs.
Oh, no.
One of them, when I first got Norman, we had three other dogs. I've always had bulldogs. For the past 20 plus years, I've had bulldogs. I had an old English bulldog that I rescued named Eli. Never name your bulldog after the starting quarterback of your favorite football team, because every time he throws an interception and you yell at the TV, the dog thinks he's doing something wrong.
Right.
But Eli had some PTSD from the people we rescued him from. When we brought Norman into the pack, he assimilated at first, but then shortly thereafter, you know, Eli bit Norman. That was the first time he got bit. And then there's been a couple other instances where he got bit. And bulldogs, I mean, if you know anything about the history of the breed, they were bred to bait bulls in the bull ring, to latch onto them, to be an instigator. That was their job. Norman doesn't even do that. Like, he's so late. Like, he's literally, like, you cannot see off camera right here, snoring so loud that I have to keep my microphone turned right a little bit, which makes me louder even more than I already am. So so we don't have the agility. There's no agility going on here. Norman is just super lazy, but the being around other dogs has got to be tough. So you don't do a lot of dog parks and stuff.
No, we tried once and it didn't work. So
yeah, it's tough. But I'm assuming Frank is he a cuddler? Does he come and, besides jumping through hoops, or is he just kind of like, I'll lay on my bed on the floor?
He sleeps on the floor until I'm done working, and then he's with me on the couch.
Gotcha. So, all right, besides Frank, I mean, is there any other hobbies or things you do?
We're baseball fanatics, so we go to a lot of Rays games.
So you're Rays fans.
And we try to travel to different baseball stadiums across the country. We had to stop when my husband's mom got really old, because we had to stay close to home.
And then
COVID. So we didn't do anything for a while. But a couple of years ago, we went on a 11-day trip, me and my husband and my son. We went to Baltimore because the Rays were playing in Baltimore.
Camden Yards is one of my favorites. Yep.
So we went to three games in Camden Yard, but we also, the day before that, the Philadelphia Phillies were playing, so we went to Philadelphia. And then the day after that, the Nationals were playing, so we hit three ballparks in one trip.
That's cool.
Yeah, that was cool.
My ex-brother-in-law, we had kind of started to plan that, but then he started having babies, you know, every 2 years, and that blew out the window. Camden Yards is really nice. I did like Camden Yards. I'm a Braves fan, so I've been to Truist Park. It used to be SunTrust. I've been to Fulton County Stadium. I've been to Turner Field, and I've been to the new stadium. I love it. So here's my question: as a baseball fan, and you're a baseball fan, but you're an American League fan, so we could talk about the whole nuance to that. I'm an old school National League guy. I liked when pitchers had to hit. I liked that it created double switches and more strategy in the game. I understand why baseball switched it to where now it's scoring, which every sport seems to be. There's no defense in football. Clearly, by the NBA All-Star game, there's no defense in that sport. Baseball's created this offensive thing. Are you guys traditionalists, or do you like the trend of home runs and strikeouts?
We're more traditionalist, but I do like the idea of the game being a little bit shorter, because the games were really long. We went to an 18-inning game once.
Oof, that's a lot. You know what? I will tell you, I do. There's something about being at a ballpark in the summertime and the smell, whether it's the stale beer and the hot dog and the grass, the way they all kind of melt together. There is something really, for me, nostalgic about that. Mm-hmm. I like seeing baseball live. I can't watch a full game on – I just can't watch a full game on TV without at least taking two naps or switching over to something else. Yeah. Football, I go to see some games football-wise. I go watch them, but it's not – it wouldn't be my first choice. Hockey, actually, I love going to see live. To me, that's my favorite sport, to be there live. But, yeah, I mean – I grew up in the Northeast, if you haven't picked up on that, but I was always a Braves fan. One of my best friends, when we were kids, he liked the Yankees, but he always loved Dale Murphy. When I was, you know, I'm 50, going to be 52. So in the early 80s was the heyday of the Braves then. They were America's team. You were on TBS. You could watch them. And I started watching them, and they were bad. And I also rooted for the Mets because I liked the National League, and he was a Yankees fan, so it made it more fun. And then the Braves just started to take off and win all these games, and it was great. Right. The Rays, I mean, last year was a tough year. They started out gangbusters. I mean, would they win 19 or 20 in a row, and then came back to earth? So that division is really, really tough. I mean, Baltimore is finally good again.
Yep.
The Rays are good. And Toronto's pretty good. I like that the Yankees and the Red Sox aren't good. I do like that. The Yankees,
that's where I am too.
Yeah. I mean, everybody's all excited. It's spring training. The Yankees are here. And I'm kind of like, eh, you know, like I grew up 20 minutes from Yankee Stadium in Northern New Jersey. And all my friends were Yankee fans. And they were the most obnoxious. I mean, Yankees fans in baseball and Cowboys fans in football and Phillies fans in everything are the worst. So that's cool. So you were right coming into your plans. Do you have any plans to go to any other stadiums?
Not this year, because we have a big trip planned for next summer in 2025. Okay. It's our 25th anniversary. So we're we're doing the Rhine River.
The Rhine River. Is that Germany?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Very cool. That's cool. So that is that like a big 14-day like extravaganza?
Yeah. We're doing 2 nights in Amsterdam and then 7 nights on the boat and then 2 nights in Switzerland. So, and the reason we're doing it is because in 2020 was our 20th anniversary, and you know where we were for
couldn't
that.
Go. Yeah. So let me ask you this: when you're planning something like that, what do you do for the business? Do you have contingency, like redundancy plans in place to someone to do that, or are you like basically on your cell phone waiting for the phone to ring to get to the next part? Like, what are you doing for that?
Well, I work with a team of women that all are consultants for this, because women tend to get this stuff differently. So if there's something that needs to happen, I have 6 or 7 others that will pick up and take care of what I need done. But I'm planning on shutting it off.
Okay, gotcha. So you have the ability to turn it off for a few weeks and go and enjoy your 25th anniversary. Hopefully there's no pandemic that hits next year. You never know what's going to happen, you know, with who, depending on who's in office. But that's a conversation for a totally different podcast. So let me ask you this. One of the questions I like to ask business owners is, you know, have you run into a hardship or an obstacle or a challenge where you were like, oh man, I don't know if this business can survive? And how did you overcome it? And how did you get through it to be able to do what you're doing now?
Wow. Okay. Well, that's a really good question, because I started working in long-term care and with insurance in 2001. And in 2007, after I had bought our long-term care plan at 35, and everybody said, why are you buying this at 35? When I turned 40, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and I never had any serious issues until recently. My fingers bother me a little bit now, but it's nothing major. But for about a year and a half, I was crying a lot, because the only people I knew that had MS were in wheelchairs.
Right.
And, you know, at the end, and they're not old. They're just, you know, not being able to do stuff. And I thought, oh no, my life is over, blah, blah, blah. Well, then I started learning that there's ways that you can counter it and make yourself healthier. And we cleaned up all the stuff, you know, we don't have ugly chemicals in our house and we eat better and all that stuff.
Right.
And now we're doing great. But what that did for my career was, when people ask me things like, well, I think I want to wait like 5 more years before I buy this, I can tell them my story and say, life shows up and changes the rules for your dad. You know,
if you least expect it, and it
doesn't care. It just shows up. So it's a story that I can carry with me to teach other people that it's not perfect. You can't figure this out exactly to make it the right time, because things show up. That next doctor's appointment says there's a hole in your, you know, things just happen. Right. So if I can encourage people to plan sooner because of that, then I'm really helping.
So a couple questions. So the first part of it is, you know, you have applicable real world experience that you can draw from to, I don't want to say convince somebody, but reassure somebody that, hey, it's never too soon. And then the question I have, two questions off of what you just said. Number one, like any type of insurance, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I'm making some assumptions here, you getting long-term care at 35, you're paying into it longer, I get that, but your premium is drastically lower?
Yes.
So like any type of insurance, if you're listening to this, if you wait till you're 75 and the only option for life insurance is Colonial Penn, where they don't do any medical check, that's your only option. But if you look at the long-term care earlier, before you have blood pressure medication and all these other things, you get a much better, more optimal price if you're doing it earlier. So that was one thing I wanted to point out. And then The other question I had for you is, when you had your diagnosis, are you able to use it? And if you use it for a year, you could stop it. Like, you have this lifetime benefit, correct? Or once you start it, you have to see it through its entirety.
No, you can turn it on and off. Most people don't, just like your mom wanted to be, you know, most people are like, no, I might need this later. But you know, you can turn it on and off. The requirements to qualify to use benefits are you have to need help for at least 90 days with something mental and, you know, cognitive in your head, or with eating and bathing and, you know, getting dressed and going to the bathroom and stuff. So if you need help for at least 90 days, it's long-term care. So it could be from a car accident, or it could be from my father-in-law fell off of a ladder when he was 87 cleaning gutters, because that's what 87-year-olds do.
Right. You know? Nobody was going to tell him not to clean his gutters. I guarantee that.
Right. Well. So yeah, as long as it's at least a 90-day need, you can turn it on and turn it off.
Okay. You just have to have that buffering period. Like, I know, like, when my dad was going in and out of hospitals, like, you have to have, like, if you're going to get admitted to a facility, you have to have like 3 nights in a bed in a hospital. Like, there's a triggering event, and it has to be those 90 days for it to kick in.
Yeah. For Medicare. Medicare needs a hospital. The long-term care doesn't need a hospital.
So let me ask you this, as we talk about this and start to wrap it up. If there's one thing, someone who's listening to this, like, I deal with, you know, what I do in the community, I deal with my audience is that caregiver that's going to be on the verge of taking care of mom and dad, or, you know, it's also the moms and the dads that are getting into that next level of their life, that next stage of their life. What's the one thing they need to know about preparing for tomorrow and you that they should use your service? Because there's competition out there. I mean, there's other people that do this. Why do we come to you?
Well, some people are in the mindset of, I'm just going to pay for this myself, right? Thinking that they're looking at today's cost, thinking, oh, if it costs $6,000 a month today, I can afford that when I get old. It's not going to still cost $6,000 a month. So some people still think, oh, I'm just going to self-fund. And it's an either or. I'm either going to have insurance or I'm going to pay my own way. And it really isn't like that anymore. It's really, how much am I willing to self-fund? And where's the gap? And what's the wisest way to fill that gap? So when I work with people, I'm learning about them, their families, what it is they would like to see. And I make it fun because this is a dreary subject.
Yeah.
And then we figure out what's the most cost-effective way to put money in a place that's easily accessible when the time comes that they need it. And now you're using the insurance first. And if it costs more than what the insurance pays, then you know where you're getting that next piece of money from this CD or from this money market account or whatnot. And you put the pieces together, and the insurance is a big portion of the funding, but it's usually not all of it. And now we're not bankrupting families because of the default plan of spend all my money till it's gone.
So let me ask you one last question before we kind of wrap this up. And it's, do you work with, like, I know for, and again, this is garden variety, this is a totally different category, but like, if I'm an insurance agent and I work for Allstate, I sell Allstate. If I'm an independent insurance broker, I might sell Allstate, Geico, State Farm, et cetera. In this particular line, or do you have a couple of different companies you work with based on the client, or do you have a company you work with that has enough menu of options for every client?
I'm a broker, so I have all the companies available. Okay. None of the companies have a big enough menu to fit everything.
For this particular line of business.
So we figure out what's the most important and what's the wisest way to build something to make it work.
Diane, great. The big question is, like, if people are saying, hey, look, I need to do this. I haven't even thought about this. I'm going to need to take care of it. What's the best point of contact for them? And then we'll put all your information in the podcast when we produce it, but tell people what they should do. Call, email, Raven, how should they get a hold of you?
Well, you can always email me, Diane@preparingfortomorrow.com. That's with a number 4. I do have a podcast called Preparing for Tomorrow, spelled out 4. I've been doing that since right before COVID. I started the podcast in 2019 and then boom, everything got shut down. So those are about 10 minutes long, 10 or 12 minutes. And it's usually just answering one question or one bit, because this is such a big thing that if I can break it down into little pieces, it's easier to digest.
Well, and you bring up, I mean, we do that also. We do branded podcasts with brands that come on and do a bunch of different stuff with us. But you're absolutely right. I mean, we live in a TikTok world where everything's broken down into 13 seconds. So for us to do an introductory podcast to get to know you, that's the goal here. And then one of the other things we do offer is exactly what you're talking about, the ability to break down. Usually we'll do like your frequently asked questions and talk a little bit about how do we touch a point or a topic for people and create that wealth of content. So guys, if you're listening to this, we're going to put all Diane's information in the podcast. But if you want to get a hold of her, you can call 813-363-6441. Diane, thank you for being a good neighbor. Thank you for being on the Good Neighbor Podcast. You have an amazing day.
You too. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thanks for listening to the Good Neighbor Podcast. Passcode to nominate your favorite local businesses to be featured on the show, go to gnppassco.com. That's gnppassco.com or call 813-922-3610.